the anti-communism, that piece of their history is very real, right? And there is a lot of trauma that we cannot diminish, because they were, in essence, had to leave their country never to be able to go back. That is a lot of the South Florida political reality, right? Enter Venezuelans who are escaping from a horrible economy in Venezuela and, you know, a real tampering down of the democratic process in Venezuela over the past several years. So they come also with the trauma of, you know, of alleged communism, socialism. The problem for those of us who have a critical analysis, right, is that communism and socialism are very profound, deep concepts, and I don't believe that they have existed in either one of those places. But
there is, and of course, they're the target of fierce U.S. sanctions to this day.
Fierce U.S. sanctions, but you know what? The point is that if you are getting Social Security in the United States today and you're benefiting from that, welcome to socialism in the United States of America. So people don't understand that, in fact, the policies that they critique are many of the ones that they're going to be benefiting from. But the point of the story is that there's a vacuum of people who hear communist, socialist, scary, it's going to change the United States, it's going to become like Cuba, it's going to become like Venezuela.
3 seconds.
And they're going to vote for Donald Trump. That's what we've seen.
Maria Hinojosa, we thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and the Patricia Reeser Center for the Arts, presenting Caleb Clowder and Reeb Wilms, celebrating the release of their new album, Gold in Your Pocket, on Thursday, November 14th. Also performing will be Dirk and Amelia Powell. Tickets and information for the November 14th show in Beaverton at www.thereeser.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today at 8 p.m. is the last chance to turn in your ballot because it's Election Day. The Oregon Department of Forestry fired one of their own officials for having an inappropriate relationship with a subordinate, and OHSU announces an interim president. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. It's not too late for Oregon and Washington voters to turn in their ballots. Voters can turn their ballots into a drop box before 8 p.m. tonight and have their ballot count. So far, election turnout in Portland, the metro counties, and Oregon more generally has been lower than in past years. As of Monday, Multnomah County saw around 45% of ballots returned, compared to 73% at this time last election. It's not totally clear what's to blame here. It could be a longer ballot in some counties, or that people are busier than they were during the height of the pandemic in 2020. For national, state, and local elections, most races won't likely be called tonight. Some states aren't allowed to start counting ballots until polls close on Election Day. In 2020, the winner of the presidency wasn't determined until 4 days after Election Day. Locally, it may take some time as well. The first preliminary results will be available for Portland races at 8 p.m. on the Multnomah County Elections website. Since it's ranked choice voting, all the votes need to be counted to see who the winner or winners will be. Ballots can be postmarked up until Election Day, but county elections officials can run the counting rounds with the ballots they do have to see who might be leading the race. Those results will be updated daily. Statewide, preliminary results will also come in at 8 and be updated throughout the night. Depending on how close the margin is on statewide races and the ballot measures, some of those winners could be declared tonight, but voters shouldn't expect to know the full results for at least a few days. The second highest ranking official at Oregon Department of Forestry, or ODF, was fired for having a sexual relationship with a subordinate. Deputy State Forester Mike Shaw was put on leave this summer during an investigation. He was fired on October 31st. Shaw had been having an affair with a female employee starting in the spring of 2022 through the summer. The report says the affair happened at times in ODF buildings, and the two communicated on state computers and phones. In a month period, it reads, they exchanged 92 phone calls and hundreds of memes, 94 of which the report lists as sexually explicit. This is a different reason than some publications had speculated for Shaw's firing. In recent weeks, Willamette Week and The Oregonian pointed to records they requested showing that Shaw also refused to allow a diversity, equity, and inclusion official into leadership team meetings. This now-debunked explanation for Shaw's suspension was picked up by the Daily Mail and the New York Post. The Oregonian also reported that the state received dozens of complaints about ODF leaders this year, alleging, quote, a hostile culture towards women, a lack of diversity, and a fear of retaliation. OHSU announced it was delaying its resolution to name Dr. Nate Sheldon as its president to replace Dr. Danny Jacobs last week. Just 9 days later, it announced today a new interim president, Steve Statum. Dr. Jacobs stepped down due to personal reasons after he was caught in the midst of an alleged cover-up of a photo voyeurism scandal. The board of directors named Dr. Sheldon as the replacement president, but Governor Tina Kotek told them to slow down. A spokesperson for the governor wrote in an email last week that the board was rushing their decision without appropriate due diligence. Statum will act as the interim president until the board and governor reach a decision for a permanent president. Board President Chad Paulson said in a press release, quote, the process for selecting OHSU's permanent president will be appropriately vigorous, guided by our values and include broad input, end quote. Statum worked in several roles at OHSU before he co-led the aerial tram project and build-out of the South Waterfront campus. He acted as general counsel, and he was chief operating officer for the Knight Cancer Institute. He's coming from the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle, where he was most recently the special advisor to the director. On Thursday, Portland City Council will consider an ordinance to end its contract with Multnomah County on homelessness. Commissioners Mingus Maps, Dan Ryan, and Renee Gonzalez put forward this surprise change at a meeting last month. The contract was recently renewed to last through 2027, and it outlines how the Joint Office of Homeless Services works to address homelessness in the region. It's been slow going to make a difference for those living on the county streets, and city commissioners want to take power back from the Joint Office. Earlier this year, they adopted more stringent standards for the office after an audit showed a lack of results. If the ordinance passes, it wouldn't take effect for a few months after the new council is sworn in. County Chair Jessica Vega Patterson has panned the move, saying, quote, it's clear these officials, candidates desperately vying for your vote this month, have their eyes on their own future and not our collective one. Disappointing, end quote. Governor Tina Kotek had criticism as well, calling it, quote, obstructionist infighting, end quote. The council is scheduled to hear the ordinance at 2 p.m. on Thursday. Portland is recognized as a strong climate leader in the country, but projects like the Zenith Energy Oil Terminal and I-5 freeway expansion are top of mind for voters, a new poll shows. Zenith Energy Management is a company that focuses on buying and building terminals for crude oil and petroleum products storage and use. It opened its Portland facility in 2013 and started receiving tar sands and crude oil from Canada and North Dakota by train in 2017. All of the products Zenith handles is destined for other places in the U.S. None of it is used in Oregon. Survey data released this week shows voters are especially concerned with how the future city council will strike a balance between PSEF and the Zenith Oil Terminal. Portland's Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund, or PSEF, was passed in 2018 with 65% support. It provides long-term funding for climate action investments focused on frontline communities or communities most impacted by climate change, like people of color and with low incomes. According to the survey, voters are more likely to support candidates who support strengthening PSEF and who opposed Zenith. Commissioner Carmen Rubio oversees PSEF, but has been criticized for trying to allocate those funds to unrelated projects. Commissioner Renee Gonzalez also proposed directing PSEF funds away from climate initiatives, like increasing the police budget. The survey showed 65% of Portland voters feel positively about PSEF, and the majority of council candidates do too. A minority of candidates support putting PSEF back on the ballot because they're concerned that the 1% tax has a negative impact on businesses. Relatedly, the survey showed just 22% of Portland voters say they feel positively about Zenith. Commissioner Dan Ryan helped approve a land use permit for Zenith in 2022, even though the city previously denied the company a land use compatibility statement. More than two dozen candidates running for city council signed a letter in October asking the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to delay its decision about approving another permit for Zenith. In the letter, they say they want the new city council to have an opportunity to, quote, review past city decisions, understand any potential enforcement liability, and weigh in during the public process, end quote. Philadelphia's district attorney says the city is prepared for any election violence. Doctors advise about how to handle election stress disorder, and Oregon has a high number of women in government. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Anybody who thinks it's time to insult, to deride, to mistreat, to threaten people, F around and find out.
Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner says the city's well prepared for any election violence. Officials nationwide are beefing up security, but an AP poll shows 4 in 10 voters say they're very worried about a violent attempt to overturn the results. Others say they mistrust local or state election officials. According to New York Times research, right-wing extremist groups are starting to coordinate on the social media platform Telegram. The paper spoke to police who warned against dismissing the thousands of messages they examined. Researchers at the University of Washington Center for an Informed Public say they're already seeing false election claims focusing on Pennsylvania, the largest swing state. Kate Starbird, the center's co-founder, says misinformation might start with a small truth, like an isolated case of a voting machine recording a ballot entry the voter didn't want, but can snowball.
When people are saying the machines aren't working, this is true. It starts as a rumor, but eventually becomes just fact. But it gets twisted into this narrative that it's an intentional effort to disenfranchise certain voters, and that's false. So we can see that sort of intentionality is one place it gets twisted.
Election officials say close margins mean it'll be a while before a presidential winner is announced. Waiting could be especially tough in the current tense atmosphere, but Selena Stewart with the League of Women Voters warns that state rules could slow the count.
Whether they can start counting mail-in ballots before or on election day, that's critical. The number of mail-in ballots in each state that they have to process and validate is a factor. Whether states allow mail-in ballots to be accepted after election day.
One place political reporters say they'll be watching is Glynn County, Georgia. Both the Harris and Trump campaigns have made last-ditch efforts to sway voters in the normally Republican stronghold. Political analysts say shifting demographics and rising diversity make it one to keep an eye on, and in future races as well. Heightened stakes are taking a toll on our mental health, and experts are giving it a name, election stress disorder. Dr. Jennifer Embry with the Indiana University School of Nursing offers tips to handle it.
Think about the people that keep you calm and really are your support people. Those are the people you need to be connecting with, not people that are going to make you more anxious, more upset. That's one thing, is to keep the calm around you.
A new report shows Oregon has the third highest percentage of women in city governments, maybe thanks to groups like Emerge Oregon, which has helped more than 100 of its alums reach elected positions. Annie Ellison, its outgoing director, says the political system wasn't designed with women, particularly women of color, in mind.
This is a system that was built pretty immaculately to keep women and women of color out, even if it's not the intention now. When do we have city council meetings? You know, most of these city council meetings are unpaid, and they're at 7 o'clock at night. If you're a caregiver, that's bedtime.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. And then from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock, KBOO presents Election Night 2024. We'll be covering the election live and reporting live updates as results roll in. Tonight's weather is mostly cloudy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 57 degrees. Today in history, Susan B. Anthony was arrested for casting a vote in 1872. Though she previously lobbied for the abolition of slavery and the rights of enslaved African Americans, she still adopted racist positions that many white women used to support women's suffrage. The quote of the day is from American journalist, educator, and activist Ida B. Wells Barnett. She championed intersectional struggles and fought for all liberation, not just the rights of a few. She said, quote, "When I saw that we were likely to have a restricted suffrage and the white women of the organization were working like beavers to bring it about, I made another effort to get our women interested," end quote. Get Out the Vote campaigns continue among Indigenous voters, and Colorado reacts to President Biden's apology last week. With more on those stories, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Today is Election Day, and it's important to make sure every voice is heard at the ballot box. That includes Native voices, who are often disenfranchised from the polls. SDPB's C.J. Keene checks in with one group looking to get out the Native vote.
The Coup Council, a Rapid City Indigenous organization, held a town hall to discuss the importance of getting Indigenous peoples to the ballot box. After a successful campaign season signing people up, ESOPA Director of Voter Organization Jean Roach says it's a challenge to encourage people to participate for many reasons.
People are like, I don't think so. And then, but just telling them that our vote can be more of a bigger picture in the very end, an invitation. And we need that. We really need that. You know, we have so many issues that are not being addressed.
Roach says housing, policing, and representation are among the most important issues facing the local community this election season. She adds these issues can be addressed along with increased representation in the Capitol if people recognize the influence they hold.
People don't realize how powerful we really are. You know, we need to unite, and by voting, that's one step towards making a difference in our own lives. And a lot of people really don't see it, but like encourage it, because maybe we're going to have a candidate up there. We can make a difference. We want to really make some changes, really good ones.
Polling location hours can be found online at the Secretary of State's website. For National Native News, I'm C.J. Keene in Rapid City.
Last week, President Joe Biden apologized for U.S. government-run Native American boarding schools. Clark Adamitis has more.
Over the course of 150 years, Indian boarding schools aimed to exterminate indigenous culture by removing children from their families and suppressing their languages and cultural practices. Children were also subject to other atrocities, including emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. Indigenous leaders at Fort Lewis College are applauding Biden's apology. Last year, History Colorado reported that between 30 and 50 children from the Fort Lewis boarding school are buried in the cemetery on the grounds where the former boarding school stood.
It has been a long time coming and something that is needed to start the healing process and so that we can recognize that history.
Heather Schotten is the Vice President of Diversity Affairs at Fort Lewis College. She is a citizen of the Wichita and affiliated tribes and is Kiowa and Cheyenne. Schotten says she appreciates Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland's leadership in this issue.
Particularly having an Indigenous person in the Department of Interior leading has probably had a great deal of influence and has been critical to have that type of representation.
Ernest House Jr. is a member of the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe and a Fort Lewis College board member.
There's not anybody from tribal communities that has not been either personally impacted by a relative, a family member, a connection by this historical trauma, this dark chapter.
House wants the U.S. government to take action after Biden's apology. He wants funding for language programs.
574 federally recognized tribes, yet less than 200 still speak our native language. The languages were stripped from these students once they went to Indian boarding schools. The culture and what made them unique was stripped away.
The Department of Interior reports that almost 1,000 Indigenous children died at federal Indian boarding schools. The state of Colorado is continuing to fund research into the state's Indian boarding schools. For KSUT and KSJD, I'm Clark Adamitis.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon. Don't forget to vote.
Microplastics and plastic products are the focus of recent individual health and climate action. The newest product called out for the danger it poses to the environment and your body are black plastic spatulas. Before World War II, the only options for kitchen utensils were metal, ceramic, and wood. Plastic utensils were introduced in the 1940s but weren't mass-produced until the 1950s. The 1970s exploded the market with single-use cutlery and packaging, like the Van Brode Milling Company that patented the plastic spork in 1970. By the 1980s, it was clear that single-use plastics were wreaking havoc on our waste management system and the environment, but industries kept producing plastic products and passed on their low costs to consumers. Though silicone is more durable and environmentally friendly than plastic, it is often more expensive. Consumers continued to purchase convenient and financially accessible plastic products until shame campaigns told them not to. Recently, environmental and health advocates targeted plastic water bottles for leaching chemicals into our body and environment. BPA-free stickers now cling to water bottles and to-go mugs to prove they are the healthier option. Just last week, The Atlantic published an article decrying the chemical leakage and environmental harm black plastic spatulas cause. It claims that cooking with black plastic spatulas leaks harmful compounds into your body because it cannot withstand the heat and chemical changes it undergoes. It quotes Andrew Turner, a researcher at the University of Plymouth, who explains the science behind black plastic specifically. Reactionary articles, like the one Gijon Meyerowitz-Katz published on Slate, say the dosage of those chemicals is negligible. Beyond the health concerns, advocates against plastic often blame the individual instead of looking at the big picture. Both individual action and collective change to society need to happen to make meaningful changes in our physical and environmental health. Meyerowitz-Katz says, quote, "So, we should almost certainly be regulating these products better, and Turner has proven that this area has under-acknowledged risks, and we need to act on that to make sure that the black plastics are, broadly speaking, safe. But personally, I'm still going to use my black plastic spatula. This is a problem that requires regulation. It's not something I'm personally concerned about in my own life," end quote. The research community reports promising trends when it comes to indigenous populations and candidate recruitment for public office. As the votes in the 2024 election are counted this week, one expert tracking this movement says as more natives are elected, coordination among office holders could improve their political clout. Mike Moen shares the details.
As Americans head to the polls this election day, researchers note there are a record number of indigenous candidates seeking public office around the nation. That positive outlook is trying to shake off longstanding barriers. Advanced Native Political Leadership says this fall, they tracked at least 170 candidates who self-identify as Native American, Native Hawaiians, and Native Alaskans, including 8 in North Dakota. The organization's Elise Blassengame says a steady increase has been building, but bigger gains are still needed to establish true representation of tribal populations.
If we had descriptive parity for Congress, let's say, we would have 15 Native members. Right now, we have 5, and the most who have served at any given time has been 6.
At the state level, North Dakota has been fighting redistricting-related legal victories for tribal areas, with groups like the Native American Rights Fund stepping in to protect updated legislative maps. Blassengame says it shows the backlash Native candidates and their supporters still face, but predicts the work being done will eventually level the playing field. Researchers say as more Natives get elected, it's important for their respective political parties to support them and encourage indigenous caucuses in state houses. Blassengame suggests having a more coordinated voice can help offset the delicate balance Native lawmakers have to deal with once they're sworn in.
They're trying to represent the interests of tribal communities, which often have to do with sovereignty and promoting the sovereignty of Native nations, while simultaneously representing the interests of other American citizens in the district.
Meanwhile, she credits the Native American Rights Fund for prioritizing the recruitment of Natives for judicial seats because of the extremely low representation for that branch. Separately, NARF just released a video feature this election cycle about the continued efforts to overcome discrimination and voter rights issues in North Dakota. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
It's the last Global Citizen Commentary before the U.S. election. In this edition, Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov writes Kamala Harris an open letter on what she should say and do. As president, he writes, Kamala Harris must distance herself from Joe Biden's failed Middle East policy. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Today's podcast is an open letter to Vice President Kamala Harris on U.S. Middle East policy. Dear Madam Vice President, In a phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu earlier this month, Donald Trump said, quote, "Do what you have to do," according to six people familiar with the conversation. You should be all over that comment, which amounts to an unqualified endorsement of any Israeli military action it is taking or will take against Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. Yet Trump is said to be making inroads among Arab American voters, whose anger at President Biden's inability to stop Netanyahu from seeking total victory has alienated many of them from you. Trump's comment provides an opening for you to distance yourself just enough from the president to assuage the concerns of Arab Americans. I believe you can take a more independent stance that conveys that, as president, you would restore control of U.S. policy consistent with our interests and values. Here is what you might say. Donald Trump has given Israel's government a green light to do whatever it wants in the war. That is an immoral and foolhardy policy. It surrenders our interests and undermines our values. As president, I would never give an ally a blank check when it is at war, using American weapons, receiving billions of dollars in aid, and relying on our political support. Prime Minister Netanyahu said the other day that Israel's interests are not American interests. The opposite is also true, for when Israel, in defiance of our best advice, rejects one ceasefire offer after another, kills tens of thousands of innocent civilians, and destroys countless homes, businesses, healthcare facilities, and places of worship, the United States cannot sit by and pretend those actions are also in our interest. The United States has consistently stood up for Israel's right to defend itself against terrorism, and I reiterate that right. But the wanton destruction that we see in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon today surely goes beyond self-defense. I cannot support that. It is not what Israel has to do. The exchanges of fire between Israel and Iran now threaten to widen the war in ways that threaten the peace throughout the Middle East. Unless these retaliatory attacks stop, they will lend support to Iran's nuclear program and encouragement to all the militant groups in the region that want to destroy Israel. And make no mistake about it, if a full-scale war erupts between Israel and Iran, the United States will be drawn into it. That's an outcome Donald Trump evidently hasn't considered. Finally, let me reiterate that I firmly support statehood for the Palestinian people. The longer the war goes on, the more difficult it will be to accomplish that aim. The Palestinian people have the right to a peaceful future, and it is my intention as president to do everything possible to give them that. They, the Israeli people, and all others in the Middle East cannot benefit from endless war. And that is the end of the letter. To be honest, I have held my punches in writing this open letter. I have crafted it with my sense of what is politically possible, though still unlikely, in Washington. Thus, I have not included ideas that I believe should be key components of U.S. policy, such as an embargo on U.S. arms transfers to Israel, at the least, on transfers of non-defensive weapons, such as the 2,000-pound bombs that are being used in assassinations, and weapons used with U.S. personnel in charge in attacks in Lebanon and Iran. Secondly, pressure on Israel to accept a permanent ceasefire as part of the end game of negotiations with Hamas. And third, resumption of nuclear arms discussions with Iran that Trump cut off and Biden has failed to resume. If the Harris-Waltz team is elected, she will presumably be a free agent, free, that is, to pick and choose which elements of the Biden foreign policy to sustain. His Middle East policy should be the first to go. It has failed to restrain the Netanyahu government, either in its lawless domestic policies or in its aggressive foreign policy. Nor, as a result, has Biden been able to implement the worthy idea of an Israel-Saudi Arabia normalization of relations. If Harris is true to her professed values, community, compassion, and faith, as she said Thursday night at a rally, she will reject the Israeli far right's ongoing effort at ethnic cleansing in Gaza and the West Bank, its expansionist dreams, and its autocratic legislative agenda under the name of judicial reform. There is little difference between opposing Trump and opposing Netanyahu. Both are power-hungry, fascist in governing philosophy, corrupt to the core, and thus unfit to lead. The United States has an unfortunate history of dancing with dictators. Let Harris break with the past and, on Netanyahu's Israel, stand for decency, nonviolence, and the rule of law. I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, Althea Billings, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Brian Bull, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Crystal Blair, Kathleen Shannon, Roz Brown, Edwin J. Vieira, and Tramel Gomes. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Maxine Dexter. Ms. Dexter is running for the U.S. House in Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. Ms. Dexter, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
Ms. Dexter, I guess the first question I had for you, ma'am, is why do you want to be in the U.S. House of Representatives? I mean, being a doctor is a pretty good gig, isn't it?
It is a good gig, and it's been the privilege of my life, quite frankly, to take care of people. But what I'm seeing is that my patients are struggling with impossible decisions, whether they take the medication that I'm prescribing or get the tests that I'm ordering versus paying rent or paying for childcare. What I want to do is make an impact.